the world entirely is at war.
Troops waiting for the zero hour.
This is D-Day.
They got one.
Veterans Chronicles. For the next hour, join host Gene Pell and an honored roster of heroic soldiers, sailors, and fighting aviators, recalling and retelling their personal stories from World War II...
A state of war!
...to the present day.
Allied Air Forces began an attack on military targets in Iraq and Kuwait.
Now the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network present Veterans Chronicles with your host, Gene Pell.
Welcome to this week's edition of Veterans Chronicles. On February 26, 2007, retired Army Lieutenant Colonel Bruce Crandall was awarded the Medal of Honor at a White House ceremony for his heroism 42 years earlier in the Battle of Yadrang in Vietnam. During that battle, Crandall and his wingman, Ed Freeman, rescued some 70 wounded comrades and flew in ammunition required by others to survive. Freeman was awarded the Medal of Honor earlier. Bruce Crandall was born and grew up in Washington State, where he now resides. His early memories are of family and World War II.
My early part of my life was, of course, the Second World War. I turned 12 when the war was starting. And I remember my dad went into the Navy. All my cousins and uncles and everybody that was old enough was in the service. My grandmother came to live with us because she needed a place, and my mother needed to go to work in a war industry. She was a welder in the shipyard, and so then my great uncle came to live with us. He lost both his sons in the war. He lost one in Bataan and one in an aviation accident. And then his wife committed suicide. So it's a family's thing. I remember is a family's. And I never understood why my great uncle Will was so sad all the time. But he had lost everything he had, really, in his life. And then as we grew up, we finally put a lock on the door. We had never had locks. The doors didn't have a lock on them. We lived in a neighborhood where anyone that wanted to could spank us if we misbehaved. The next door neighbor had a stick on his front porch, a little switch, and he would catch us. And if you got in trouble at school, when you got home, it was a lot worse than what went on at school. And I played ball from at every sport in grade school, and then I played baseball. It was high school. I made All-American. I was my batting average was three times my grade point.
Did you ever give any thought to a career in baseball?
Oh, you bet. I wanted to be drafted. The high school baseball stadium complex in Olympia is named after me now, and I hit over 600. And I never hit less than 400 in semi-pro ball even before I played high school ball. So I wanted to be drafted by the Yankees, the Orioles. Even the Cubs would have been an experience. But I got drafted. I was 18 years old, and I got a letter in the mail that says, "Greetings, you've been selected by your friends and neighbors." And I stomped on my two friends and then checked the neighbors out, and they all said they would have had me drafted if they had a choice, but they really didn't get that opportunity. But in those days, I knew that, you know, so when I was 19, I was, my whole new year in 53 started out as a draftee into the Army, the Big Green Machine. And if anybody told me I'd make a career out of it, I thought they were crazy. The Army sent me all the way to Fort Lewis. They spent a couple of dollars sending me 12 miles from home.
Well, they sent you a whole lot of other places, too. Everywhere from the deserts in Tripoli to the jungles of South America to the jungles of Vietnam. You did a whole lot of moving around the world early on. Mainly in topography, as I recall.
As topo pilot, and later that skill level, I got into leading that type of operation. And I was the Defense Mapping Agency Director in Venezuela, my final overseas. But, yes, I served in the Arctic and in North Africa and every country in Central and South America except two. And my wife and I are actually in our 53rd home. So we've made an agreement to, if either one of us suggested we, the other one kills him. And so we don't have to worry about moving again. We have a RV.
You were drafted, but how did you get the bars on your shoulder?
I went to through AIT, and while I was in AIT, a sergeant had a love affair with my buddy and I, and he called us in the office one day, and he said that if I continue to allow what's happening to happen, you two might make corporal someday, and I can't have that on my conscience, but you'd make great second lieutenants. And so my buddy and I went off to leadership school and then to Fort Belvoir here in Virginia and became engineers. And after that, then flight school fell in. But in those days, the Corps of Engineers had the most aviators in any one group. In the 30th Topol, we had 98 aviators and about 50 aircraft at that time, and that was before the air assault and the large units were formed. And we had an outfit in South America called the Inter-American Geodetic Survey that was very active. And I loved to fly, but I also loved being an engineer. So I had to balance those careers, and my only actual official flight time was in combat. The rest of it, I was an engineer in topo and mapping, and I had been a company commander of a combat engineer unit and a headquarters company and a line company, and I had served at Fort Belvoir, at Fort Leonard Wood as the deputy chief of staff there, and then I got a combat battalion there, the 5th.
We flew just about everything I could think of. I mean, you weren't flying F-15s or anything like that, but all kinds of other planes and helicopters.
Yeah, and I love both. The great thing about the Topo, we were the bush pilots, and I flew floats, skis, and wheels. I flew otters and beavers, and one day I would fly a helicopter in a mapping operation. The next day I'd be overhead at the cover ship flying the otter or the beaver or doing cargo missions. So it was great fun as far as satisfying. I loved it. But it was tough. It was a tough time frame because being an engineer, they expected you to have a degree and of course, when I got drafted, I didn't. So I had to went to school for 17 years at night and on weekends, and finally found a school that would give me a degree. And then 7 years later, I got a master's in public administration. And those things both helped allow me to move up in my career. But I was always as an aviator engineer instead of an engineer aviator. And the Corps of Engineers basically didn't want aviators except for Topo. And that was too bad because now, of course, we have a branch. There's an aviation branch, and that's much fairer for assignments and for opportunities because we didn't get sent to school. We didn't get the opportunities that the regular engineers that came out of colleges or out of West Point. Corps of Engineers was a number one option in those days from the military academy, the top 10%.
Well, how did you move from that to combat?
In 1964, I was in Costa Rica mapping and got a reassignment to Fort Benning to do the air assault. And I started out as a platoon commander one of the lift outfits, and we went into the Carolinas and we did the training and the maneuvers, and I ended up then moving up in that battalion. I went from to an airfield commander slot, and then I went to be an XO of the gun company, and then the battalion adjutant, and then I took the command of the, well, I first went down to the Dominican Republic, which people forget we went there in 65, and then I took command of that unit and took it to Vietnam. And one of the dumb things that the Army did in those days was when we were ready to go to Vietnam, and it was shifting from being the 11th Air Assault to being the 1st Cav, they took all the guys who had been to Vietnam out of the units. And, of course, this was commanders, too. So I lucked out. The commander of the company that I ended up commanding in Vietnam had been there, and so I got it. And I got to stay in command a year, and I led 756 missions that first year in the lead helicopter.
Now, you were there at the formation of the 1st Cav Air Mobile?
Yes.
And which Harry Kennard had the responsibility for,
yes,
putting together.
He was the top dog.
And he's been on this program
before. Wonderful man.
And has been at our annual convention the last few years, but he was too ill to come this time around. But he did a marvelous job in putting that thing together, and it was the first of its kind. In fact, at the time, the only of its kind.
The interesting part of that, there were two lift battalions, and they had four companies in each one. Our battalion was a 229, and three out of those four companies were commanded by engineers.
Our guest this week is Medal of Honor recipient, retired Army Lieutenant Colonel Bruce Crandall, and our conversation will continue after these messages.
Veterans Chronicles is presented by the American Veterans Center, an educational foundation dedicated toward preserving the legacy of America's servicemen and servicewomen of all generations. The center is home to two organizations, the World War II Veterans Committee and the National Vietnam Veterans Committee, each working to tell the stories of their respective veterans. In addition to this program, the American Veterans Center is also the primary sponsor of the National Memorial Day Parade, held annually in Washington, D.C. For more information on the American Veterans Center and its programs, visit the center's website at www.americanveteranscenter.org or call 703-302-1012, 703-302-1012. You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. I'm Gene Pell, and my guest this week is retired Army Lieutenant Colonel Bruce Crandall, a recipient of the nation's highest award for valor, the Medal of Honor. On November 14, 1965... Crandall led the first major operation of air mobile troops into a landing zone in Vietnam's Yadrang Valley. He recalls the mission.
The enemy attacked the Special Forces camp at Plai My, and the Cav moved up from An Ke and to relieve that pressure on them. And the country was the central part of the country was the enemy was trying to cut it in half. The highway that runs down through there is an ideal place to do that. And so we moved up onto Pleiku to support the Plai My. Now, those people that were attacking Plai My withdrew, and we started to chase them. Now, what we were doing was to try to cut them from getting out of the country.
Well, you only were allowed to chase them to the border.
Yep, and that's where we went. And so one evening, General Moore was a colonel then, lieutenant colonel, and General Knowles was the DCG, and Colonel Brown was the 3rd Brigade commander. And I was in the meeting that they were at, and they kept putting their hands on the map and looking for places and saying, okay, tomorrow we're going to go, but we need to recon it. And so the following morning, I took off at 6 in the morning to pick up General Moore, or Colonel Moore, and his staff. And we did the recon. We flew over to the border when it flew up to Duco, which was a Special Forces base, and landed, and we looked at the opportunities. And that's when we picked X-Ray and Columbus and a fire base called Falcon. And so we knew we could support it from the fire base. And when we got back, we picked a time frame to hit the landing zone. And we took off to make that hit, that time, in the LZ. And the important part of that is that we got airborne in the fire base. The artillery was not operational yet. But so I'm airborne, and I'm wasting fuel. And 20 minutes, and that turned out to be a very critical to the aviation part of the support. Because we made 4 trips into the landing zone with carrying the units of the first to 7. And they were blocking for an enemy coming from the east to get out of the country. That was the thinking. In reality, we got hit from the west. They come down off the mountain and out of Cambodia. So we were very surprised. But on the fourth lift in, we were by at that time had 8 aircraft going in at a time. I had 16 coming, and the very last aircraft got hit on that lift. Well, we had to refuel. Now, you never want to have a refueling in the middle of an assault. So, and it was created by the fact that we didn't get off and didn't have the artillery prep. So now I'm my 8 aircraft are refueled, and we come in, and all hell breaks loose. They're enemy in the landing zone. They're standing up there. They're shooting people off the aircraft. They're shooting people trying to get wounded on the aircraft. And 4 out of my 8 aircraft on that flight had to be grounded when we got back, including mine. And I had 3 dead and 3 wounded when I got back out of the landing zone. I had 2 guys, the company commander of D Company and the mortar platoon leader, both got wounded, but got out of the aircraft and stayed in the landing zone. And I must have picked up a couple of wounded. I'm not sure where they came from. But my crew chief was shot in the throat. The radio operator for the telecompany was shot in the head. And when I got back on the ground, the aircraft was had to be grounded. So before I got back, I realized that we canceled the second 8 aircraft. I realized there was no way we can continue going in there. And Moore agreed. And anyhow, we canceled the second 8 aircraft, and they went back and landed. And I realized that this is a lot worse than it looks, because I knew they only had the ammo that they took in, and I knew, having been an engineer, a company commander twice, the Corps of Engineers always reorganizes as infantry, and then we always run out of ammo on these training things. So I knew what they had in there, and I sent a couple of birds back to Pleiku to get more ammo, and I took, when we landed at Pleimi, I took all the ammo that was around there and put it on my aircraft, and Ed Freeman, and I asked for volunteers to go with me, another aircraft, because you want to divide the shooting. You don't ever want to go single, so they concentrate on one aircraft. So we had the 2. And when we got back there, I asked Moore if he needed ammo. And he said he sure did. And so we made the run in.
When we return, Medal of Honor recipient Bruce Crandall remembers the events which eventually led to his being awarded the nation's highest honor for valor. You're listening to Veterans Chronicles on the Radio America Network. We're
World War II.
The German news agency said today in a broadcast that the Allied invasion had begun.
Korea.
The armed invasion of the Republic of Korea by armed forces from Northern Korea constituted a breach of the peace.
Vietnam.
The curfew is in effect for the Saigon, Cholon, Jiezhen area.
The Gulf War.
The skies over Baghdad have been illuminated. Bright flashes going off all over the sky.
A special thanks to veterans everywhere from the Radio America Network.
Heavy fighting is still raging.
3,639 wounded.
Red light, green light, and out, out. Get out.
Gentlemen, this is the real thing.
The brutal death march of Bataan.
Germany calling. Germany calling.
Right in the purest face.
That's the ammunition and
the law. For Harlem operate.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network. Once again, Gene Pell.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. I'm Gene Pell, talking this week to retired Army Lieutenant Colonel Bruce Crandall, a recipient of the Medal of Honor for heroism in Vietnam. The Battle of the Yadrang Valley was the first encounter of American forces with North Vietnamese regular troops, and it was a fierce fight.
The enemy was just overpowering. They were really pouring into the landing zone, and they were in the trees, and they could be seen from everywhere.
Now you're flying an unarmed aircraft.
Absolutely. I thought for years that we had machine guns on them by then. We didn't get machine guns until the 4th of December. I found that out later, and Joe Galloway's pictures were what confirmed it, because we had no way of knowing. We had no air weapons on the aircraft, and top it off with, some of my pilots didn't have their weapons issued yet. We were supposed to have 38 caliber pistols that went under our arms. I had one because I medevaced a pilot in the advance party, and I stole his. But we hadn't received all of our chest plates. We didn't have the armor plating, and we didn't have the weapons. But that really didn't make much difference, because you didn't have a choice of whether you go or not, and you wouldn't make it based on the weapons anyhow.
How many runs did you make in?
22 during the day, 14 after the after we closed the landing zone for the regular lifts, and 12 after I tried to get out of the medevac to go, and they refused. And so for 12 lifts, it became necessary for us to go to not just get ammo and water and medical supplies in, but
to extract.
Take out the wounded.
Right. And between you and Ed Freeman, I've read somewhere that you rescued something like 70 people.
Well, we probably took out more than that, because we took out dead people. We took out people that did die. But we know that 70 lived for a certain period of time to be medevaced back to the States. Now, there's others who probably died, but yeah, 70 was the figure that was, and that's pretty accurate because we looked at how many were wounded that day, how many were killed, KIAs. And the interesting part is the following morning, the 14th, when all this happened, we saved 70% of them wounded. The following morning, I was loaded with the rest of the 2nd of the 7th to bring them in, and was supposed to lift them in at 7 in the morning. And Moore got hit at 6:30. And nobody went. I didn't know about it. Medevac refused it again. And they ended up losing almost 70%. I think 42 died and 20-some survived out of the casualties. So it's proved what the helicopter, how the importance of the helicopter. Because on the second day, you would think the infantry would have better positions and it would be more, there would be less casualties. And of course, in the movie, it shows the enemy coming down the hill. And we saw that. Now, the importance of the Yadrang and X-ray was that for the very first time, a president in a sitting Secretary of Defense were able to make a decision that impacted on our ability to fight the war on the battlefield. Because that was a time that in the day that they decided we would not hit the enemy in Cambodia. And so we ended up taking all those casualties and not being able to fire the artillery on them coming down the hill. And we could see them. We knew they were there. And the movie showed them being underground, but I doubt like hell if they were underground, because they didn't have to be. We were not bombing them. We were not shooting artillery at them until they got in direct contact with our troops. Mm-hmm. And that was the first time. And McNamara and Johnson made that call. And it wasn't until, I think, 73 or 70, 72, 73 before they finally went across the border and worked on them.
Well, wasn't the only interesting call that Johnson and McNamara made before the whole thing was over. Well, what finally turned the tide there?
I think in the Idrang, just the quality of our infantry was fantastic. The artillery support was well done. We'd trained so long together. And then finally the Air Force and Navy brought in the bombing. And so the enemy had to come down the hill to attack. And they had the same problem more. They ran out of ammo. They only had what they carried. And so they only could push that as long as they could fire the ammo they carried. Then they'd have to go back and get more. And so there was a kind of a cyclic effect. And they finally gave up because they were taking such a beating anywhere close in to the combat zone. Mm-hmm. And then the really bad part of the Idrang happened, and that was Albany, when we lost 155 dead and 125 wounded out of the 2nd to the 7th, and I think the 1st to the 5th, one unit. But it wiped out the 2nd to the 7th. Mm-hmm. And we... the bad thing is that we went back in into that area several more times while I was in Vietnam. The first time, and then 12 months later after I was sent back, we were back in Vietnam, back in on that border in the same landing zones, because we didn't maintain the territory. We would attack, kill, and
leave.
And we had a complete change in attitude, because when we went in as a CAV, went into the country, it was search and destroy missions, and we looked everywhere we could find the enemy. We attacked them with the infantry, and we were violent in our carrying out of war. But my second tour was back with the CAV, and it was 12 months and 12 days between, and we had what we call search and avoid missions. I don't know what the commanders called it, but I know what it was called down at my level, and it was that we'll find them and fight them with an 8-inch gun, or bomb them with the Air Force, or, you know, but try to keep putting an M16 up against an AK-47, because by then we knew we weren't, and that was in 67 until January 68 when I got knocked down.
How did that happen, by the way?
Oh, geez, that's a long. The U.S. Air Force dropped two bombs on my helicopter while I was in flight. They had a target they were supposed to hit at 7 in the morning, another one at 10, and I had a down command helicopter. It was the 1st to the 8th command element was on board, Charlie, and they were all dead. But I was going to recover them and their weapons on the aircraft. And so the following morning at 7, we were to move out, and about 6:30, I get the call from that the Air Force couldn't get off because of weather. And so I said, okay, cancel this 7 o'clock and hit the 10 or 10:30, whatever it was. And at 10 or 10:30, they bombed the 7 o'clock target, which happened. I was 10 feet off the deck shooting miniguns at a sniper. And for a short period of time, I didn't know what the hell happened, because it cartwheeled me across the rice paddy, just like you see on a NASCAR. We there was nothing left of the helicopter. I crawled out where the windows should have been, and crawled over into the ditch in the rice paddy. But the guy was shooting at, I didn't get him, and they didn't get him. And he got up out of that hole and was very aggressive. He wanted to kill us, and I had a cover helicopter that saved us. But I spent 5 months in the hospital thinking bad things about the Air Force.
Let me go back to that engagement for just a minute and a different kind of thought. You were awarded the Distinguished Service Cross for that.
No. First, the Distinguished Flying Cross.
The Distinguished Flying Cross. You and Freeman were flying side by side.
Yeah.
Same mission.
Yeah.
Same kind of danger, same kind of activity, et cetera.
I know where you're going.
Well, of course you know where I'm going. Why?
Okay.
Why was he awarded the Medal of Honor and you had to wait until February 2007?
Well, go right back to what was one of the problems we had. In Vietnam, no aviator in the CAV was nominated for an award higher than the Distinguished Flying Cross. The Army records, they went back and they established that. Well, the reason for that was that could be approved at division level. And you didn't have to do all the administrative stuff. So the Silver Star and the Distinguished Flying Cross became the level for the infantry and the aviation. And it became a cap, in effect. And even though we had some of the heaviest fighting, in 1966, I did a rescue with Morris people, again, Tony Nadal, and on the Bong Song plane, and I received the Aviation Space Writers Award for that. And it was, at that time, it was the beginning of it was international, civilian military, any helicopter action. And 20 years later, that was ranked as the number one rescue of that whole 20 years. And yet, it was a Distinguished Flying Cross for the CAV. And we would never have been reconsidered for the Medal of Honor, except that in 1994, I think it was, Congress went back and passed a bill that opened all wars for reconsideration of awards or for consideration of awards. And it required certain things. It required, if it was reconsideration, it had to be afforded through Congress. And if it was original, it had to go through the military branch. Well, the reason they did that was because of the unfairness of the system for the Tuskegee Airmen and the Japanese Americans and a senator from Hawaii. Most people don't know that a former President of the United States received the Medal of Honor in 2001. Teddy Roosevelt got it for San Juan Hill on the 16th of January 2001. And that's when they picked up those people, and they went back and we were put in. Well, the Army, somebody denied the medal, the Medal of Honor. They said DSC was appropriate. Well, then we put it. It didn't follow the steps. It was supposed to have gone through Congress, and it didn't. So the Army agreed to reconsider Freeman and mine, and I had mine pulled because if Freeman and I go up together, it's not going to happen for him. So, Ed, you have to understand, he's my brother, but he's more than that. We were friends for 10 years before he went to Vietnam. His wife and his kids, I'm Uncle Bruce, he's Uncle Ed to mine. And he was the only one that volunteered, really, to go when this battle took place. I was a commander. I had no real option. So he's the one who deserved to be considered. Well, then it took 6 more years, and it actually got lost when it was resubmitted. I got an email that said, despite an exhaustive search, would you... we've been unable to find the Medal of Honor that was recommended by General Moore. Well, there's been a second one already recommended, and what I think happened, somebody threw it away, and they took the second one, which had no horses with it, but then General Moore, I called him, I told him I wasn't going to send it in, it was his, and he said, send me a copy of what he had sent me, and it got signed. General Moore signed off on it, and General Knowles and General Kennard. So it really didn't leave him much room once it was reconsidered.
Thanks to retired Army Lieutenant Colonel Bruce Crandall, a recipient of the Medal of Honor, for sharing his story with us this week. That's it for this week's edition of Veterans Chronicles, produced by Tim Holbert for the American Veterans Center and Kenny Burns for Radio America, in association with Pelcom Communications. I'm Gene Pell. Thanks for listening.
A special thanks to you veterans for your service to our country.
The latest official report from Washington said that warships had broken off the action and retreated.
From the Radio America Network.